You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Tracy, one of my favorite memes from last week was Liz Lemon from 30 Rock.
I saw this one, I think. Yeah,
she's like, wow, long year, huh? And Jack goes, Lemon, it's only January 12th.
Yeah. Yeah. This is going to be a... Oh boy. I tell you, man, this is a hell of a time to be a unionized teacher in a public school environment.
Now, I did send you, I did send you, and I'm sure you did not see it, but I also sent it to Joe. So Cannoli Joe has seen this, and obviously he critiqued it immediately and for facts and stuff. But there's a lady who has a theory that, we have been stuck in the darkest timeline, but what's happening is the Cubs and now the Bears going towards championships.
Oh no!
Is breaking
it's the blame Chicago timeline?
No, it's breaking the curse. And so when the Bears win and they get to the Super Bowl and they win the Super Bowl, it will break the curse and we will be released from the darkest timeline.
Oh, I mean. I've watched a lot of Bears games this season, like a lot of Bears games. And I don't, it's already stressful enough, that fourth quarter hallelujah shit they keep doing. Like, Bears, I don't know, man, if I can handle the idea that us escaping the CERN Weaselverse is actually dependent upon, dislike.
Bears games, Bears games are like spells in Pathfinder and skills and feats in Pathfinder. You have to read the last fucking line.
Yeah.
That's the one that changed everything. That's why you have to wait until the fourth quarter, until that last 30 seconds.
Oh, it makes sense. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Huh. So during that rant, at least two smiles and chuckles from our guest. So.
Who is an excellent sport already for guest number two of 2026. Welcome aboard, Seamus Sullivan. How are you?
I mean, you know, I think we're all grading on a curve right now, but, you know, grading on that curve, I'm doing great. I'm really excited to be here practicing out my listening gestures that I make when my dad is talking to me about sports. I was breaking those out just now.
Oh, nice. Good job. Yeah.
So that's going to help me stay, like, you know, in good form for the next family gathering.
Whenever I talk about sports on the podcast, I am literally, to quote Rob Lowe, speaking to 1.5 guests or 1.5 listeners. Like that's my audience. 1.5. Because there's someone who's like a half sports person as far as I'm concerned. Like, but yeah.
The fact that you didn't name drop who the half sports person is means that you're gonna have like a dozen people going like, Is it me?
Yeah.
Does he mean me?
And then I'll have the Sheldon moment where I'm like, oh, so the half sports person thinks it's
oh man, it's no wonder that that people always join and always stick with that Patreon with perks like these, huh?
Hey,
on air, you know, roasting.
you come for the Just Us episodes and the hangouts, and you stay for the constant barrage of bullshit from me.
That's probably true, because otherwise they have to deal with a bunch of like pseudo brainiac bullshit from me, and that gets tiresome.
Yep.
But that's also why we have guests, because they help break up both the squirrel bullshit and the brainiac bullshit here. So, all right, you are joining us in celebration of and conversation of, congratulations, your debut novella, Daedalus is Dead, which, in addition to having a banger of a title, has a banger of a premise. So can you catch our listeners up on Daedalus is Dead?
And happy birthday.
Book of the birthday.
It's nice. It's very nice to be talking about it. The premise of it for folks who aren't like super into Greek mythology is the famous story of Icarus flying too close to the sun. His father Daedalus is a famous inventor in Greek mythology. He invented the labyrinth in which the Minotaur was imprisoned. He invented the wings in which they both try to escape the island of Crete. And I have always been kind of interested in him as a character, because he's one of those rare male characters in Greek mythology who is not famous for stabbing dudes.
but I want to put that on a t-shirt. it's like his Father's Day card. Thanks for not stabbing dudes, Dad.
Even Odysseus, who is like famous for being wily and having good stratagems, that he's very good at tricking you so that he can then stab you. So he yeah. doesn't get to go into that category. But I've always been very interested in Daedalus being someone who is famous for his creativity and the way that it gets co-opted to feed people to a minotaur, the way, you know, it's able to give his son this incredible science fictional experience of human flight that then ends in tragedy. You know, was always just kind of hypnotic to me. My story is, it actually starts with the fall of Icarus. It is mostly about Daedalus descending into the underworld to try to reunite with the spirit of his son, to try to understand why his son, who is not just a dummy, didn't heed his warnings, and beginning to kind of understand the toll of his own complicity in the horrific things that were going on the island of Crete. Just some background for this. I wrote this about a year after our son was born, near the beginning of the great 2020 COVID-19 pandemic, a year in which a lot of great and normal stuff happened. And I had a lot of anger and frustration and sorrow about, you know, the systems that were like very visibly chewing people up that entire year, and my own connection to those, and my own fear that my son would grow up to feel like he couldn't get away from being connected to that machinery. So that's kind of thematically what the book is about.
Yeah. Oof. You know, I think that there's always for storytellers, this kind of interest in going back to stories that have taken shape in previous eras and under previous storytellers and kind of putting your own stamp on them and your own twist on them. But I do think that right now we're in this kind of interesting cultural moment of the relationships between parents and their children that I think makes this concept, I don't know, it feels particularly salient. You know, particularly I've got older kids. You know, my son's 18, my daughter's 14, and they've grown up in this world where there's increasing, I would almost say, encouragement for children to distance themselves from their parents as they get older, not just in the sense of like be financially independent or things like that, but in the sense of like to be estranged, to cut ties, like to find if you have friction with a parent, that the solve of that friction may be to kind of give up on the relationship or to walk away from that relationship. And so
then take a job and move 2,000 miles to Tennessee?
Could be that. Yeah. And so given that, I feel like there's an opportunity in addition to this kind of like breakdown and complicity narrative that you're talking about here for this book to kind of touch people in this moment of feeling that there's this greater fragility in the relationship between parents and children than we may have realized in the past.
That's I didn't know about that. I don't know, that kind of social pressure you describe. And that sounds tough. That sounds like a lot to be dealing with as a kid or as a parent.
Isn't that just an extension of quiet quitting?
I think so. I mean, it's complicated. And I don't want to, in talking about this, cheapen
the same psychology behind it. It's like, this is bullshit. I'm not dealing with this. I'm going to go do something different.
Yeah. And I think for some, I think the movement of parental, like intentional estrangement started with people who had trauma experiences with their families growing up. Like there had actually been like real issues of abuse and documented harm. But I think that it's sort of expanded through discussion spaces on social media and so on into more of a sense of like, kids don't ask to be born. They don't get to decide who their parents are. If they can't get on with their parents, if they have friction in their relationship with their parents, it's not on the kid to fix this, and they have the right to walk away. And it's interesting to see this play out, not just in social media spaces, but another, because I teach at a boarding school. So my students have an actual opportunity of sorts to walk away earlier in life than they might otherwise might. You know, I have a son in college now. And so there is a literal kind of walking away that's happening there that's just intrinsic to the experience. And so the idea of the father who says, this is what we need to do to be safe. Do this thing with me, but don't do this thing. Do this, not this. Mm-hmm. And the kid's like, I'm going to do the other thing. Goes back to what you were saying, that it clearly can't be that Icarus is just some kind of dum-dum, that there's something deeper seated here.
Exactly. And it's interesting to hear you talk about all this, because I haven't seen the phenomenon you're describing with estrangement exactly, but I have seen this tendency, especially in certain internet conversations where things tend to get flattened and things tend to get made into binaries that don't really exist, that there is this strong desire to like remove yourself from complicity, mm-hmm. to remove yourself from systems that are not right, to remove yourself from people who are tangled up in those systems, which I definitely understand, especially when there's like there's a safety or a self-preservation angle to it. But like, I also feel like in a lot of situations that's a mug's game, because there is no way to not be engaged in a system that is doing bad things. I think you do have to take on that system one way or another. That desire to get away, that desire to be separated from it, is very much a part of the book and very much connected to that estrangement in the book too.
To fly higher.
Oh, look at you with the metaphors. Gold star. I'm also kind of having a weird moment here, and this may be because I just recently wrapped up teaching a course on Andor and its kind of connections to anti-fascist movements and so on. So I've kind of got Andor and Andor adjacent storytelling on the brain. But it dawned on me as you were retelling the framework of the Daedalus story, Seamus, that it does feel a little bit. Do we think that Star Wars took a leaf from Daedalus and Icarus with Galen and Jyn Erso discuss? Because we have the engineer who is stuck in a system that he's complicit to but wants to escape from, and the child who is born under that system but then given the opportunity to escape, but then, I don't know. Am I off base here?
Seamus, have you seen Andor?
I have seen season one. I have not sat down with season two yet, although very
well. The Galen and Jyn Erso thing is a Rogue One reference, because like Galen Erso is the guy who made the Death Star.
Deliberate estrangement from certain elements of Rogue One that frustrated me.
Got it.
Specifically, Jyn's arc being going from someone who sees her father killed by the Empire in the opening scene to someone who, in the back half of the movie, decides it's time to get serious about fighting the Empire. But that's actually my flippancy aside, that's a really interesting way to look at that. That's really interesting. I will say even Galen does take that stand of being like, well, I put in this exhaust port just above the main port, and I want people to know about it. Mm-hmm. So you could read that in a hopeful way as saying like, there eventually, if you have any relationship with humanity and decency at all, you will be put in a corner where you will have to take some kind of a stand, which is like, that feels hopeful to me. That might not feel hopeful to everyone, but
yeah.
I don't see the correlation that you're trying to draw. I would almost go as far as like, I think pushback from kids against their parents and their parents' rules and what they're telling them to do. And like, parents are always going, if you will just listen to me, I have life experience and I'm trying to help you. Mm-hmm. But the kids are always going, you're stupid. I need to learn it myself is kind of the message. But it's really like, you don't really know what you're talking about. I'm going to go and I'm going to prove you wrong. And then they kind of learn.
It's the ultimate kid touching the hot stove story.
Yeah, it's kind of how it's always been. And you almost feel that in the Icarus story, right? Because it's almost like, yeah, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. Well, I'm going to fucking do it. You know, I'm going to you're not right. Like, come on. You can't be right. Like, no. Like that's where I think. And I don't see that with Jin Erso. I don't know. I don't feel like – I feel like she went a completely different direction. Like she's just going to be a thief and do weird things. And yeah. Because she ends up with – what's his face from Clone Wars? The guy who starts doing the
– Saw.
Saw Gerrera. Yeah, Saw Gerrera. Who learned to be a rebel kind of sort of from Ahsoka. Right. And pushing back against the separatists. Right. Yeah, the separatists come to his planet and he and his sister are fighting resistance. And then that's where his whole arc starts. And he just becomes weirder and weirder and crazier every time you see him. And I don't know if that's the way it was written or if that's just Forrest Whitaker.
Why not both?
Because this character's whole deal is kind of that he's the rebel who the other rebels look at him and they're like, that guy could do anything. We don't know what's going to happen with him. He makes us really nervous.
Yeah. And then there is the scenes in Andor where you learn that like he starts huffing some weird gas stuff that just like fucks with his brain in really weird ways. And so he just becomes more and more and more crazy. And like, we just got to blow them all up. Like, we just got to blow them all up. And if you're Jin and that's who you grow up around, who knows what she's going to be? Mm-hmm. So I guess my whole point is I don't see it, Tracy.
Sure. Sure. That's fair. That's fair.
I could be wrong, but I don't.
It's a swing and a miss, maybe. Yeah.
I almost see it in a little bit in, the art dealer in Andor, whose name I can't remember.
Luthen Rael.
His assistant. Yeah, because they like they have that same thing where like he takes her in and she grows up in that system of just constantly being a rebel and constantly like doing that stuff. And I can almost see it there.
Going back to something that you said earlier, Seamus, and connected to something Patrick said, this idea of like the parent trying to guide and give structure and say, do these things for your own good and so on. Like Patrick was saying, I have experience. It's interesting because I think that there's the implied thesis of experience trumping all, right? Like the parent's been there, done that. Don't do the thing. Don't put yourself in danger. But then there's also the interesting set of circumstances where the children actually do have a valid knowledge and perspective of a world that isn't understandable in the same terms as the parent thinks it is. You know, the don't fly too close to the sun works because the sun is a big fucking hot thing and has pretty much always been a big fucking hot thing and will be until far distant beyond the point that we have any care about it any longer. But there are other things like see people talking about like, oh, I lost a job and I'm having trouble finding it. And my dad's telling me just to take my resume door to door to places. And I can't get him to understand that that's not how anything works. And
literally.
Yes.
What my mom said to me.
Right. And so there is this sort of interesting tension of, yes, true. Sometimes experience in inviolate circumstances, this is literally the way the world and the universe works, has its value. But there's also the fact of like the world changes and has nuance. And you talked before about the flattening of perspectives and arguments about things. And the lack of understanding of those changes can mean that it actually is possible that your experience is no longer valid, that you can talk to your child from all sorts of life experience. And they're like, no, you really don't get it. And this isn't just a sort of your uncool mom thing. This is you honestly do not have the operant information.
And I think something else can also happen too, that is not entirely fair to your parents, but like, if you grow up with, you know, you grow up usually learn, ideally you're going to grow up with some understanding from them of how the world works. And if that story about how your society works, how it's supposed to work, if that story fails you eventually, as you know, I think for a lot of people, it started to fail in the last 10 years, not everybody. You know, I'm a cis white man from the suburbs. So I was taken aback by some of the stuff that has been happening over the last decade. And I think when that story fails you, I think it is very easy to connect it to your parents and to not blame them for better preparing you for your whole view of the world to be challenged, even if that's not really fair to them.
Sure. I just saw a thing on how, like, the question was, why can two people look at the same video?
Oh.
And you know what video I'm talking about at this point, given that it's January. But two people can look at the same video and come to wildly different conclusions about that video and what's happening in that video. And, you know, it all comes down to people focus on different things, right? They focus on something, and then every single time they watch, they focus on the same thing over and over and over again, because they come with a notion or a preconceived notion in their head of what they're going to see, and then that's what they see. They just focus on what they want to see. And I think that tends to happen a lot with the parent-child dynamic as well, right?
Yeah.
Parents are struggling to kind of say, if you would just listen to me for a second, I can totally help you with this problem that you're having. And the kids, all they hear is wah wah wah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, what you're talking about there is what psychologists call confirmation bias, yeah. Right? That whole idea that we all carry around some usually pretty unexamined assumptions about what is true and the way the world works. And when we encounter something that puts us at the risk of seeing that challenged,
by the way, Tracy's just being attacked by her cat. I think it's Opus.
Jesus, no, it's Hobbs. It's Hobbs. Okay. No, this is Hobbs is really mercenary about this stuff. Opus will attack me physically. Yeah, Hobbs attacks the peripherals.
Hobbs is attacking. So we should just
okay.
Make that. No. Yeah.
So yeah, okay. Oh my god. So anyway, I'm gonna try and make an intelligent point here, and I may in fact be wounded in the process.
You will pay attention to me.
It feels like 2026, and I'm just gonna keep talking.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
We
so
now
the camera
have a view of the workout
of
room.
The rest of the basement.
Because the camera
guys.
Got knocked around. That's hilarious. That's the first time that's ever happened, Seamus. So
that was incredible.
Yeah, you've never actually even seen that side of the room before, Patrick. It's been 6 years and that's never happened. Okay, it's so I'm just holding it right
that?
Now.
Wow.
Yeah,
he just
smacks
this,
the camera yeah. clear off the computer.
We've had lots of Hobbs visits, but we've never had one this hilarious before.
What are you doing, you insane little bastard? So anyway, before anybody, you know, I'm just going to pause in this pause already to say that before anybody thinks that we're like a really high class, high budget outfit, this is a big no. Yeah, because I'm on a folding table with a laptop and a basement right now and a crazy cat who is wondering why he's not being fed. The thing about confirmation bias, though, getting back to the point, is it has less to do with what is actually present in the evidence of our world one way or the other than it has to do with the fragility of our own perceptions, right? And so, like, if you are a liberally minded person and you're seeing the video that Patrick is alluding to, you don't want to admit of the possibility that there is behavior on the part of protesters that could be viewed as sassy and inflammatory and incendiary. And so you are eager to pronounce it as all peaceful and reasonable and so on. And at the same time, if you are on the other sort of side of a political spectrum, you don't love the idea that there are no punches being thrown, no one's yeeting a rock at an agent here. There's no direct physical threat. He's positioning himself right in front of a vehicle, et cetera, et cetera. You don't want to process those flaws in the schema either. And so both sides had this extremely motivated reasoning, right? Where this is not to say that victims of extrajudicial violence are victims of their own choices, but to say that like the situation is fully and completely complicated, and that there's literally not possible to have unbiased observers of them. In the same way that like, I am Daedalus, I am going to the underworld to speak to the soul of my son and find out what happened, and that they will never be unbiased observers of one another, right? Like I will never be an unbiased observer of my relationship to my parents, and my kids will never have the same for me. And it's kind of uncomfortable to sit with that and to realize that like we are part of a casting call in someone else's brain.
Very much so. And I think, and a lot of the book gets into this. Before we get into any of this, I don't want to get either of you in trouble. I just want to say on mic, fuck ICE, defund ICE, and abolish the agency. I just want that to be part of my transcript on this conversation in January of 2026.
Yeah.
But then I want to get back into this very interesting thing you're exploring, which is our self-image, I think, is very connected to that too. Our identity, which social groups we feel loyalty to. I think this is, again, something that we see in what you're describing. You're going to look for the information that allows you to uphold your loyalty to your in-group, because there is a social penalty if you don't do that. And that is a, you know, again, not to excuse anyone who, defends the indefensible out of that sense of loyalty, but that is a human survival mechanism that, you know, I think does get exploited to great effect. You know, your sense of who you are and the fact that your memories of all your experiences are this story that you are telling yourself about who you are. I think that is something that really affects perception and memory too. And that's something that I also try to dig into with the book, because I find that very fascinating and very scary. And that felt like something that was really ripe for exploration in the story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, there are two things. Serious thing is that the New York Times has a fascinating study of the video in question. And basically showing all the different angles and all the different videos together and analyzing it. So that's worth your subscription if you want to go check that out. Number two, I like the fact that Daedalus in your book does eventually get to Icarus and finds out that the reason Icarus won't listen to him is because every time someone comes over to the house, Daedalus would bring out carvings of Icarus running around the house naked as a baby.
Oh, yeah. And the embarrassing etchings.
So badly.
Throwing his food at the wall.
Yeah.
So
it's no good.
Badly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can't top that in the dad joke department. Not that I would ever try. So it seems like this is probably a good point for
to get away from the mood serious. Picks of the week. Yeah. To
yes.
Get away from the serious.
Yeah.
And have something
time
fun
to time
second.
To do picks of the week. Yeah.
Hey, everybody, Patrick here. And before we get to Picks of the Week, I wanted to take a moment to thank you for listening and talk about a couple of ways you can help support the pod. First off, if you're subscribed via Apple Podcasts or Spotify, simply downloading new episodes each week helps with the algorithm. Those nasty algorithms. If you're doing that on one platform, thank you. But could you consider doing it on the other one as well? You don't have to double listen, but with how the podcast landscape has kind of fractured over the past few years, being subscribed and downloading the episodes each week on both platforms really helps us out. I don't think Google Podcasts exists anymore. I think I got like some emails about that. But if you're there, hey, you know what? That would help as well. Second, we have a Patreon over at patreon.com/functionalnerds, and some changes are coming there very, very soon. Starting in February, we are eliminating the $10 tier and moving all the perks from that tier to the $5 tier. That's right. The $5 tier will now include our exclusive monthly Just Us episodes for the patrons. Those are wildly popular, and we want to be able to open that up so more people can listen and enjoy those episodes. We're also going to add a new Discord server. It's currently in beta testing, and that'll give us a new place to chat and grow our community away from all the AI bots and things that Meta is doing with groups on their platform. But wait, there's more! That's right. We have even more stuff to plan for our patrons in 2026 to thank them for their support. So, this is the best time to jump over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and back us at that $5 tier if you haven't already. You will get all the new goodies when they drop, because I'm not going to put a $10 tier back. It's all going to be right there on the $5 tier moving forward. Okay, I think that's it for me. So let's get back to picks of the week.
All right. So, Patrick, you've got us all warmed up for hijinks and good times here.
I kind of want to pick Hobbs, but
he is an amazing creature, this toothless bastard.
Yeah. But what I'm going to do instead is I received some amazing Christmas gifts this year, and one of them is a board game, and I'm going to put on my GM voice for this. The Search for Planet X.
Ooh.
I'm going to show it on video just so you two can see it, but the others can't. This is a game from Foxtrot Games and Renegade.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a 1-4 players. It uses an app as well as the game itself. So you kind of do stuff together. And do you know the theory of Planet X? This is real.
I do not.
Oh, wasn't it? Tell me if I'm wrong about this. Didn't astronomers think for a while that because of the gravitational math didn't add up, there was an extra planet out there that we just
I'm remembering this now. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And I think they still do. I don't think that they have solved or unsolved that math. I think they still do,
but I'm not 100% sure. Planet.
But basically, they're saying like the way all of our gravities work in our solar system doesn't add up. And they think that there's something out beyond Pluto that is affecting gravity throughout the solar system, and they've called it Planet X, but they can't find it. Essentially it'd be a low light planet, like something that's not getting enough light to be reflective or something like some. And so this game is The Search for Planet X. And you are, you're doing stuff. The whole purpose of the game is to try to come up with surveys and look at different things and try to find this Planet X. So it's very, very cool. It's very much in my wheelhouse. It says that it takes about an hour to 75 minutes. So for myself and my friends, that would translate to 4 to 12 hours. to play one session of the game as we're trying to figure it out, and then going, oh shit, we've been playing it wrong this whole time.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's it. The Search for Planet X. And some friends gave that to me for Christmas, and I thought that was very kind of them. And that's my pick this week.
Fantastic. That's a good one. That
sounds rad as hell.
Yeah.
Hey. So Seamus, what rad as hell thing are you going to recommend?
We've been talking about how we're doing, how a lot of our listeners are maybe doing. It is January of 2026. We've got a very exciting year ahead of us. Something I have been getting a lot of genuine joy and solace from is a song called The Best Goddamn Band in Wyoming. There's a lot of context for this. So it's a song by No No Boy, which is the stage name of folk musician and historian Julian Saporiti. And he does just like really like kick-ass Americana folk rock music, a lot of which is real stories from like various Asian American diasporas, which sounds like homework, but like the guy's got like an awesome singing voice, like it can really put together an incredible song and a melody. So all his work is great. And this particular song is inspired by a real band. It's called The Best Goddamn Band in Wyoming, and it is inspired by the George Egawa Orchestra, which was a swing band made up entirely of Japanese Americans who were interned and put in a Heart Mountain concentration camp in Wyoming during World War II. And so it's a great song. It is a really interesting window into a shameful fucking chapter in history that seems very familiar now. And the thing that I get out of the song is, here were folks where the U.S. government was doing its utmost to deny them their humanity, and it didn't work. You know, they still found each other. They formed this swing band. They made art together. Eventually, they were let out of the camp on passes to go and play venues, and then they had to come back to the camp after that. But they spent 3 years doing this. You know, decades later, that song is still, you know, the music they made together is still inspiring new music today. So that actually gives me a lot of hope. I think that even though we have a lot of work ahead of us, I think moments like that, moments of people still retaining their humanity and making art together, are why fascism and white supremacy are ultimately going to fail in the United States. And so give it a listen.
Nice.
That is super cool. I had not heard of them before.
Yeah, No Boy, fucking rad as hell band. I'm hoping to catch him doing a show next week. I'll drop a link to his Bandcamp if either of you are interested.
Nice.
And enjoy.
Very cool.
Very cool. So kind of along similar lines of feels especially timey, especially in the year of our Lord 2026. Last night, my mother-in-law and my daughter and husband and I got together and we had dinner, and we ended up watching the latest of the Knives Out movies, Wake Up Dead Man. Which came out about a month and a half or so ago, maybe 2 months ago. I forget exactly. We've been meaning to watch it for a while. And my mother-in-law is a huge, huge fan of murder mysteries. She had seen Glass Onion and the original Knives Out on her own and with us previously. Deirdre's a huge fan of murder mysteries. So very much up everybody's wheelhouse here. And it's my pick because I did like it very much. I think it is not my favorite of the three of the films, but I think the reason that it's not my favorite is the reason why it's a good film, which allow me to explain. The first two films, like the first one's just really well crafted and engaging. The second film is like very popcorn-y, rewatchable, although it's a little tropier than the first one is. The third one is in a lot of ways doing two things at the same time. It's like a meta commentary on how mysteries work, because part of how the mystery unfolds is that we discover that a lot of the earmarks of the murder that has happened can be linked back to very famous murder novels. And so there's a little bit of that going on. But equally importantly is it's a movie about a kind of ideological idolatry. You know, it's a movie about using, this case, the literal pulpit of a small Catholic church to foment anger and fear and to work on people's worst instincts. And what that does to the people who are subjected to it and how they kind of enslave themselves to a mode of thinking that if they were to stand outside of it and be objective, they would recognize they don't actually agree with and they don't actually take comfort in, but because of their own fears and vulnerabilities and ambitions, they've kind of enslaved themselves to it. And in a lot of very direct ways and that are super on the nose, and in some much more subtle ways, the film is kind of trying to talk to us about how systems of value and belief and cultural warfare have kind of metastasized in the United States today. And it does it through a pretty bang and murder mystery, which as a lapsed Catholic definitely has some pun intended Easter egg stuff going on in it that are really interesting. So if you have not yet seen Wake Up Dead Man, it's a longish one. It's a little bit more than 2.5 hours, but it is a juicy, juicy piece of work that is definitely going to leave you thinking for a while afterwards. So big ups on that one.
Very cool. And that's on Netflix.
It is, yes.
I will also throw out, if you are into murder mysteries, I think they just dropped Agatha Christie's Seven Dials.
Cool.
On Netflix as well, which I think is a limited series, not a movie, but it could be
yes. wrong. I'm finding myself more and more interested in the limited series format than the movie format in any case, because I think the limited series format, they have some space to do some smarter narrative things, but yes. I digress. Yes.
Yeah.
Agreed. We've kind of been in that conversation before. Mm-hmm. All right. So Seamus, this has been quite a journey here. Before we part ways, though, I want to give you a chance to do something a little bit fun. You mentioned that your book came into being in part because of your own first fatherhood experiences at the start of the pandemic. So can you end with a fun fatherhood memory? We'll put aside tragedy and anxiety and estrangement and all of that, but like fun fatherhood memory from these last 6 years.
I was promised an hour of uncut sadness, and that's what I came here to do.
I mean, your kid's like what now? Four or five. So talk about when the child stole the car and took off and like that.
Right?
He turned six tomorrow. Actually, that's
nice.
That's why they're dying.
Way to go, kid.
Ground. I didn't just get them to celebrate being on the podcast, although that's part of it. So I'll tell you a story from the book tour, because we have two now. Our eldest is about to be six, and our youngest is three. So the book came out at the end of September, and we did our local bookstore the first weekend of October, I think. Shout out to Word here in Jersey City. It's a great bookstore. Everyone there is super friendly and cool and will recommend books to you if you want them to.
Word
stop in if you're in the area. Yeah, they're great. They're great. So we were doing our local book event there, and all our friends came and my sons came. And I started by trying to read a little from the book. And then our eldest was like, oh, you can come up and you can read a book into the microphone. I am going to bring all these books of animal facts that I found and share them with the audience, because I think they would like to know some cool animal facts.
That kid sold a dozen copies easy for you right there.
Yeah.
He needs to go on tour with you everywhere.
if it was up to him, he would. He will follow me. He will track me down. He will storm the stage. Mm-hmm. Wherever there is an opportunity. So everyone learned a lot of cool animal facts. And then my youngest, who is at that age where he's very contrarian, he got up and he just kind of did this wrestling heel move. He grabbed the microphone and he said, "Birds are not dinosaurs," just to like see the shock on everyone's faces and like hear the hissing and the booing. So they were both really on that night. So that was a nice experience to have with them.
His first contrarian shit post. You must be so proud.
I thought I would have many more years to prepare for this, but I was wrong again.
Alas, alas. One of my favorites, not that anybody asked, but what the hell. So when Deirdre was small and was at the point that she was like able to advocate for her own food choices and, you know, use words descriptively for meals, she, you know, had very strong opinions about what she wanted to eat. Mostly they were perfectly fine and normal kid opinions, but she did have a basic misunderstanding about meat, in that she believed that all meat was chicken. She understood that like there were things that she ate that were definitely not chicken, that were meat, but she still called them chicken. So any type of meat you put in front of her, she would eat it. And then she would be like, "I really like that, was good chicken." Like, you know, side of beef, that was good chicken. Hamburger, that was good chicken, et cetera. And so we were going through an Italian beef restaurant's drive-thru. That's not too far from my house. Living in the Chicago area, Italian beef drive-thrus are in fact a thing. And so when we were coming through the drive-thru, she's in the back in her little booster seat thing. She's like, Mom, I want to make my own order. And I'm like, I don't know about that, kid, but okay. So I pull up kind of janky to the window so that the backseat window can be more facing the microphone. And I'm like, okay, we're going to order this and this and that. And then my daughter wants to make her own order here. So, okay, D, tell them what you want. And she goes, hello, I would like the chicken that is beef. And there's this absolute silence on the other end as some like probably 16-year-old kid is like, do you want the chicken fingers or did you want the beef sandwich? And be like, I want the chicken that is beef. I don't know. I'm like, I'm really sorry. She wants a beef sandwich. She wants a beef sandwich with cheese. She calls everything chicken. It's fine. It's just like, no, mom, I want the chicken. This is like 5 minutes. There's a line behind us. Everyone hates us right now. We got up to that window to pay and they were just dying laughing on the other side. And she, of course, insisted that I roll up in such a way that she could take the bag from the bag. Aww. So the bag is like as big as she is. And she's like, thank you for my chicken. And they're like, for real, was there chicken in the order? Like, no, if it's all beef sandwiches, that's fine. That is actually it is fine. And so every now and again, I'll be like, hey, kid, what do you want for dinner? And she's like, I'd like the chicken. That is beef. Yep.
I got
so
one.
Anyway, that's parenting.
I got one, and I'm not even a parent.
Oh, yeah.
But I used to help my cousin with her kids when we lived in Fresno because she got a divorce and she had four kids and all the kids needed stuff. And so it got divvied up between the family who would take people different places. And couldn't pay, couldn't do anything, right? But she would reward by going, why don't you come over Friday night and we'll watch a movie with the kids and we'll have pizza. And she'd buy pizza. And at the time, I didn't have anything going on, so I would do this every once in a while. And this one time, we met up somewhere, and she's like, here's some money. Go get a movie. I'm like, okay. And she's like, get a kid movie. I'm like, okay, I'll get a kid movie. And her youngest goes, I want to go with Patrick. And the youngest had never gone anywhere with me before, had never done anything with me before. And her mom's like, oh, okay. And she's looking at me like, do you want to deal with this young child? And I'm like, it's fine. We're going to Blockbuster. It's not a big deal. So get her in the backseat.
They're about how old, can you say?
I want to say she was probably 6 or 7 at that point. But it did involve like moving some stuff around to get her in the backseat and, you know, in the right seat and all this kind of stuff. And so I take her in my little Ford Tempo and we go to Blockbuster on the way to my cousin's house and we pull in and we go in and she's like, I want to pick the movie. I'm like, okay. You know, so we go around the kids section and she finds the one that she wants because she never gets to pick a movie. I think this is part of her plan. And so she picks a movie and I see this movie and I'm like, all the other older kids are going to be pissed. So I grab another movie.
Yeah.
And we go and we're standing in line and she's just sitting there and she's holding my hand and she's got her movie in her other hand and she's just looking around and the place is packed, just absolutely crowded with people. And all of a sudden, really, really loudly, she goes, Patrick, you're so nice. Why aren't you married?
Damn.
Wow. And damn. All of these soccer moms turning and looking at me and I'm like, what, 17 years old? Still right. In high school. And I'm like, oh my God. So that was the day I died. I died of embarrassment that day.
Yeah. 17 your ghost
years.
Has been functioning very well since then. Hence the name of the podcast.
Better than Blockbuster.
Oh, look at this guy. It's hard to top that for a closing up episode. So on the theme of doing readings, different places and all sorts of stuff, Seamus, where can people find you and the cool stuff you make?
Oh, man. So I finally set up my website. It is Seamus-Sullivan.com. Don't go to SeamusSullivan.com. Go to Seamus-Sullivan.com. And you can find Daedalus is Dead at bookshop.org. You can get it at your local indie bookstore. If you like it, tell your friends. And if you don't like it, tell your friends because it's short.
Yeah, it's fine. They could have different opinions, and that's healthy. All right. Thanks so much, Seamus.
Hey, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Great talking to you both. Great meeting you both.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our episodes, please, please consider sharing it with your friends on social media and give us a like or some stars on the platform or the podcatcher that you're listening to us on. If you'd like to keep up with the Functional Nerds on social media, the official podcast socials are as follows. At the-functional-nerds on Facebook. At Functional Nerds _ podcast on Instagram. Shut up. I couldn't get the same one. It just didn't work that way. So hush. And you know what? It's going to get worse here. And at thefunctionalnerds.bluesky, which is BSKY, .social. I know. I couldn't keep it copacetic. I tried, but hush. Tracy and I have our own accounts. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. You can find us by searching. If you want me, it's ATFMB because that's just my handle everywhere I go. Or you can search for Tracy Townsend and find Tracy on social as well. Our Patreon helps keep the lights on and new episodes like this one coming out week after week, which we've been pretty good at. I mean, we're very consistent, so you might consider checking us out over at patreon.com/functionalnerds just to support the pod and help us out there, you know? It does help. Thanks again for listening. And I have one question for you before I go. Is it baseball season yet? Because football's trying to kill me.
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, "Hey, I really love what you do," I'm like, "I'm sorry. Do you know who I like? I think you have me confused with someone else."
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.